and welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Claus Dimes.
I'm Brian Rohenbacher and didn't think of a Christmas name.
Brian the Elf Rohenbacher.
Yeah, I guess so. Hopefully I'm not a cotton-headed ninny muggins.
No. Well, some days. No, just kidding. We've got a really great show for you. Some Christmas-themed topics that we're going to be tackling. And yeah, you want to just unpack them?
Definitely. Yes, I like that. Yes. And we're kicking off the Christmas season. Yeah. So leading up through the rest of this month, it's going to be Christmas segments here and there. Yeah. So we're excited.
Fun times. Yes. And you have time to think of a Christmas name.
I'll have one by next episode.
All right.
Well, we have RTB 101. We're going to be hearing from astrophysicist Hugh Ross as he talks about the Christmas star.
And in Give and Take, Jeff Sorenk will be talking with biochemist Fuzzle Rana about thought-to-text technology. I don't know about you, but like my talk-to-text technology fails me every time. So thought-to-text.
I'm actually nervous about that because if it's thought, like, does it have time to filter things out?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Talk-to-text is like, do I have a speech impediment? Like, he's messing it up.
Well, it sounds like this is going to be a good segment, though. First up, we have Culture Talk. Sandra's going to be chatting with philosopher and theologian Ken Samples about the meaning of Advent. Let's check it out.
Now it's time for Culture Talk, where we talk about culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. And I am joined today with philosopher and theologian Ken Samples.
Hi, Sandra.
Thank you for joining us.
Sure.
We're going to be talking about what I understand is your favorite season, besides basketball season maybe, is the Advent season.
It is.
So I hear you say that word often, and I think some people might not be familiar with what Advent is. So can you explain what that word means?
Well, if you think back to kind of the more traditional liturgical churches, so we'd include Catholic, Orthodox, Anglican, Methodist, Lutheran, they have what we call a traditional church calendar. Right. And instead of all of the days that might be on our calendar, it centers around the birth, the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus. So Advent would be the beginning of the church year, even though it's in December. It's the beginning of the church. It's Jesus coming into the world. But then it would extend on down to the heart of the Christian year, which would be things like Lent and Good Friday and the resurrection. And so this is a kind of, this is a way of looking at our lives in light of the great events of Jesus' life.
So Advent season then, it's a whole season distinct from Christmas Day. So what, what involves the Advent season?
Yeah, so it would be largely the four Sundays that precede the coming of Christmas. You would have the celebration of Advent. The word means coming, and so it's a time in which Jesus's followers would be anticipating that coming, looking at their own lives in light of the great coming of the Lord. And it would be a special time of singing songs that relate to the doctrine of the incarnation or God in human flesh. And it would accumulate in singing Christmas carols and the celebration of Christmas.
So then when we see people with their Advent wreaths and they have like four different candles, it's all representing each Sunday within that season.
That's right. And it's seen as a time of celebration, but it's also seen as a time of introspection. You know, what will the coming of the Lord mean to me? And so it's my favorite time of year. I love it when we sing Christmas carols in the church. It's a great time.
Right. And so you mentioned another word that maybe some people might not be familiar with, and that's the incarnation. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, it's a Latin word, so it's not in the New Testament as it was written. The New Testament was written in Greek. But carne means flesh, so a carnivore eats flesh. It means that Jesus has come in the flesh. The Greek word that's used is sarx, where we have sarcasm, the cutting of the flesh. So this is the great biblical teaching, the great historic Christian teaching, that Jesus is the second person of the Trinity, but now he has taken on a human nature and become man. So the early Christians would call him in Greek the Theanthropos, or the God-man. So that's, and his work will lead to his death and ultimately to his resurrection.
And God, man, when you say that together, it's still having his divinity, but also having his humanity.
Truly God, truly man, mm-hmm. a single person with both a divine and human nature. Mm-hmm.
So what are some things that you think are important to reflect on during the Advent season?
Yeah, well, you know, think about the visited planet. Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody once said that it's a remarkable thing for a man to walk on the moon, but it's a greater thing for God to walk on the earth. Mm-hmm. So when I think about that, I think that God has taken a human nature like me. Mm-hmm. His nature is not sinful as mine is, but God has visited the planet. I mean, if we met Jesus, he was a carpenter, he would probably have calluses on his hands. Mm-hmm. God has come and lived our life. He's mm-hmm. suffered with us and for us. And so I view it as a God who has wounds, and it all began with the birth of Jesus in the womb of the Virgin Mary.
Right. And there is a lot that Christ did, even in his birth, to really show that he was for everyone. So can you give us some examples of Christ's birth and how it was inclusive of all people?
Yeah. Well, if you think of the shepherds in the mm-hmm. fields, you think of the kings that come. This is a universal proclamation that there's the coming of the Messiah, the coming of the one who will do God's bidding. Mm-hmm. And so if you think of Israel being in the east, this is going to be inclusive of people in the east. And then later, as Christianity spreads, it will be inclusive of the people in the right. west.
And I think that's such an affirming message, especially now, is that Christ was born for all and died for all. And I think that's just an encouragement. So when we think about Advent season as your favorite season, what are some traditions that you hold to that make this season so special to you?
Yeah, I even when I was a kid, mm-hmm. I like the decorations. I mean, I used to tell my parents when I was a boy, they're getting ready. And I like that. That's what I communicated to my kids. You know, we're preparing. Mm-hmm. I like Christmas trees. I like decorating the Christmas trees. I like lighting the Advent candles. Mm-hmm. I even like the purchasing of gifts. God has given us his gift of his son. And so I think it's a time for cooking and mm-hmm. a time for celebrating and a time of reflecting about this deep mystery that God has taken a human nature. Wow, that's extraordinary.
So let's say you're having some sort of Christmas gathering. I mean, not that we're going to get into like a deep theological conversation, but what are some little tidbits that might be a source of comfort for someone who has fallen away or who really is kind of curious about this man called Jesus?
Well, I think that the greatest part of Christianity is Jesus himself. What I like to do is to collect together select biblical passages that talk not only about the birth of Jesus, but talk about his identity. I mean, even in the Old Testament, he's given these titles, these divine titles. I like to have select scripture passages that people in my family can read and we can talk about. And of course, one passage that is really special to me is when Jesus says, you know, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, mm-hmm. and I'll give you rest. Mm-hmm. Only Jesus can give somebody rest for the soul, and we all need that.
Right, especially during such a hectic, busy season.
Yeah, right.
Well, thank you so much for that, Ken. I know that you love Advent season. Yep. So if you would like to learn more about this season, go to reasons.org and search Advent.
Welcome. This is Joe Aguirre along with astronomer Dr. Hugh Ross. We're continuing our conversation. Hugh, you're going to answer the question today. What was the Christmas star?
Well, Matthew 2 is the one place that talks about the Christmas star. The Greek word that's used for star is the word aster. It can refer to any kind of heavenly body. So it could be a star, it could be a planet, it could be a galaxy, it could be a meteor, a comet, an asteroid. A shooting star, anything like that, that would qualify as aster. It isn't a singular, so it's really referring to a single object in the sky as opposed to multiple objects. But there have been a variety of explanations speculated over the last 2,000 years. Everybody seems to have a theory on what the star is. the most popular theories I see is the idea that it was a big bright comet or a supernova or a conjunction of planets or a planet-star conjunction. And in the slide you're looking at right now, this is a slide of the comet Hale-Bopp. I saw it when it was bright in the sky. It was literally the brightest object in the sky. But something of that nature would have been too spectacular, because one thing we notice is when you look at Luke 2, the shepherds were surprised by the arrival of the angels and the newborn son. They were out there with their sheep at night. If there was some spectacular event in the night sky, they would have noticed it. The other thing you can see is that Herod and the religious leaders in Jerusalem were mystified about this star. So it was something that they did not notice. Also, we recognize that only Matthew records this starry event. The Egyptians don't record it, the Greeks don't, the Indians don't, the Chinese don't. So in my opinion, that would rule out something that would be truly spectacular in the night sky. And everybody at that time was paying attention to even relatively faint comets. So I think the comet explanation is ruled out. Moreover, when it talks about the star here, notice in Matthew 2, the star appears in the east, it disappears and reappears when they're on their way from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. And they refer to it as the star, the same star. Now, you know, comets can make a trip around the sun, but when they reappear, they don't reappear in the same position in the sky or with the same characteristic light pattern. So a comet, I don't think, would work. And likewise, I would argue against the supernova explanation, because supernova in our galaxy, this next set of slides shows you a supernova in a different galaxy. But what it shows you is that when a star goes supernova, for a period of a few weeks, it shines as brightly as all the rest of the stars in the galaxy. Literally outshines 100 billion other stars. And when a star in our galaxy goes supernova, it's so bright you can see it all day. I mean, you see it in the daytime, that's how bright it is. And this is something that, again, the Chinese, the Indians, and the Egyptians are very meticulous to record, and there's nothing in their writings. Moreover, no supernova can repeat. When a supernova eruption takes place, it's a one-time event. And so that'd be inconsistent what we see there in the text. The most common explanations given is that it's a conjunction of planets or a planet with a star. And this next slide shows a conjunction that took place between Jupiter and Saturn and the moon in 2009. Conjunctions are relatively common, which again makes me skeptical, because they're so common. Why would the wise men pay so much attention to one conjunction that they would actually mount a major expedition and head to Jerusalem? I think they'd be looking for something a little less common. Moreover, we're talking about a conjunction of planets. This is something everybody paid attention to. Again, Herod and the religious leaders seem to be oblivious to this starry event. And it was, for example, there was a conjunction that many interpreters appeal to between, in 2 and 3 BC, where Jupiter and Venus came within a seventh of a moon diameter in one case and a 30th of a moon diameter in another case. The second one where they actually merged and looked like a single star. But that, again, would have been too spectacular. Everybody would have noticed it. And they would say, oh yeah, we saw that event. And we don't see that in the Matthew 2 text, and we don't see the shepherds responding to it either in Luke 2. So I'm skeptical about the recorded conjunction of Venus and Jupiter in 2 and 3 BC. And now, more common again, is a conjunction of a major planet with a star. And probably one of the more common interpretations is Jupiter having a close conjunction with Regulus. Again, these are quite common. They literally happen every year on a basis. So, but what catches people's attention is, at least in today's terminology, Regulus is in the constellation Leo. You know, Leo, the lion, the tribe of Judah. So people kind of make a connection with David and Judah and Jesus. And then you have Jupiter, which is referred to in many cultural contexts as the king star. So people pay great attention to that. Now, I'm kind of leaning personally towards the idea that it's a recurring nova. Supernova can't repeat, but there's a very rare class of novae. You say, what's a nova? Well, unlike a supernova, a nova will go from being virtually invisible to being quite bright, but you won't see it in the daytime. A spectacular nova is typically as bright as, say, the North Star. So it won't be the brightest star in the sky, but people who are paying attention to the sky, looking at all the constellations night after night, would be quite aware of what they call a guest star, a new star that shows up in the constellation. And a very small percentage of novae have the potential of recurring, where the star would explode, become, say, as bright as a North Star, disappear from view after a couple of months, and then, say, a year to 2 years later, it could reappear in the same character. The advantage here is it reappears in the same position in the night sky, same position on the celestial sphere, and would appear with the same light characteristics, and it would be a single star. You know, one of the problems with a conjunction idea, you're referring to multiple stars, not just a single star. And Matthew 2 puts the word aster in the singular. And when the Magi see the star again, they refer to it as the star, the same star they saw back in the east. But keep in mind, it's just one chapter, actually just a portion of chapter 2 of Matthew. We don't have a lot of details about the star, but I think that's about as far as we can push it based on the data that we have and the historical recordings that were around at that time that we see in Luke 2. So I lean towards the idea it's a recurring nova, and I'm skeptical towards the other explanations, but nobody can claim to have positive proof as to exactly what the star is.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink, and welcome back to Give and Take, the segment of our show where we explore important scientific ideas and see how they relate to the truth of Christianity. Today, I'm joined again by my friend and colleague, Dr. Fuzz Rana, and we're going to look at transhumanism and a cool new development, which is thought-to-text technology. Fuzz, it's good to have you here today.
Jeff, thanks for having me. It's always fun to hang out.
So I look at this technology and the idea that you can connect up something to your brain and with no movement of the person, you can get thoughts out into a text seems pretty phenomenal. So why don't you give us a little background? Can we actually do something where we're taking thoughts and putting them onto paper with no motion by the person?
Well, you know, it sounds a lot like science fiction, but the fact of the matter is this technology is an imminent reality thanks to the work of a team of researchers from Howard Hughes Medical Center. But they are working on what is known as a brain-computer interface. And this is a fairly recent development in biomedical engineering in which you can create these electronic devices that can either sit on the scalp or reside on the surface of the brain or even be embedded into different regions of the brain that serve as an interface between the brain's electrical activity and computer software, computer hardware, and again, machine hardware. And so people have explored using these brain computer interfaces as a means by which to afford patients who are suffering from locked-in syndrome or who are amputees or quadriplegics or paraplegics to be able to, with their thoughts, control, again, computer software that allows them to communicate or can control robotic prosthetic limbs or even exoskeletons that would give movement to people that, again, are unable to move or give them access to limbs when they have lost their limbs. So the technology is still in its infancy, but it holds the promise of revolutionizing biomedicine, particularly for those groups of patients.
That's pretty phenomenal. I mean, so if I get what you're saying, you basically take a bunch of electrodes, inject them or insert them into the brain, which obviously requires a lot of care. Or is it, do you actually have to inject it or insert it into the brain? Or is this something where it's done external to the brain?
Well, depending on the computer interface, it can be done either externally or to the extreme of actually embedding through surgical procedure, the interface into the brain itself. The gold standard is to for performance is for those brain computer interfaces that are implanted into the brain, because you get a cleaner signal and you get higher resolution in terms of being able to specify regions of the brain in which you're recording electrical activity. So in the study done by the Howard Hughes Medical Center, they actually implanted an array of electrodes in the motor cortex, which is the part of the brain that controls movement. So that's the way that they were able to get specificity and resolution in their brain-computer interface.
Okay, so whether you're going invasively or external, effectively, it sounds like what you're doing is reading the signals going on in the brain and bypassing maybe the broken, whether you got an amputee, whether you've got just some sort of mechanical problem with the body's physical or with a person's physical problem, and being able to generate the outcome. That's basically the idea here, correct?
That's right. And in some of the earlier versions and the more simplistic versions of brain computer interfaces, the patient is learning to control electrical activity in their brain in such a way to affect mm-hmm. the movement of a cursor on a computer screen. The more sophisticated ones that are now being developed actually involve a collaboration with the patient and the actual hardware and software of the computer brain interface, where people are using machine learning algorithms to record electrical activity in the brain, and then from that extract intentionality and then act on that intentionality. So the thought to text brain computer interface involved that kind of a technique, where there was a machine learning algorithm that was incorporated into the design.
So, I mean, it sounds like, you know, the ability to help someone who's got a disability or some sort of physical problem, it seems like this is just an obviously good thing to do. Is it just inherently good, or are there concerns that go along with it?
Well, I mean, there's a host of ethical concerns that go along with it. You know, one concern is that these brain-computer interfaces may actually alter the personality of the user. For example, brain-computer interfaces have been used to treat Parkinson's disease, where you can send electrical stimulations to certain parts of the brain, and that helps to arrest Parkinson's symptoms, but that the user's personality actually changes as a result of that. And so now it becomes a question of who is actually responsible for the action. Is it the actual user, or is it the user in combination with the interface? And so that's, you know, something that's being considered, that these now represent an opportunity to enhance human beings beyond our natural biological limits through the use of these kind of interface technologies.
So, I mean, it seems like there's kind of a fine line between helping people do things better, but that technology almost inevitably will be used to transform, or in an attempt to transform humanity. It seems to me, as a Christian, you know, you want to help people, but you also have to recognize that God created us for a purpose. And so how do you wrestle with that as a Christian?
Yeah, it's a very difficult issue, because the line between enhancement and therapeutic use isn't always that clear to begin with. So it's a rather blurry line, and so the one concern we would have, of course, as Christians is the technology fundamentally altering human beings in such a way that we lose humanity, or we become dehumanized, or are these technologies actually allowing for a more full and complete expression of what it means to be a human? So somebody who's locked in and can't communicate, being able to communicate allows them to recapture their humanity. But if you're trying to use these brain-computer interfaces to augment your intellectual or psychological well-being, your intellectual capability, your psychological well-being, are you at that point altering human nature in such a way that you really are creating something that is beyond what is meant to be a human, a post-human? And that, you know, to me would be of a deep concern from a Christian perspective.
Thanks, Fuzz. I really appreciate your comments. You know, when I think about brain to computer interfaces, my immediate thoughts are of the Borg or of Terminator, these kind of cybernetic organisms who are going to take over the world and eradicate humanity. But the reality of it is, we can use this technology to actually help people who have disabilities or amputations to be able to restore their ability to function and to have good relationships, to give them some of their humanity back. And so we want to develop it so that we can use it well, but we also have to recognize there are abuses of the technology. So we need to think about how to use this tool well. would encourage you to go to reasons.org and check out Fuzz's latest blog on this topic. It's called New Thoughts Detect Technology, Biomedical Utility or Post-Human Progress. Gives you great insight into some of the science that's going on behind all this, but also equips you to engage and participate in this important conversation about how do we use this important tool.
That does it for our first Christmas episode of the season. We hope you enjoyed it and that it helped encourage you to share your faith with confidence and compassion.
And don't forget, subscribe to the show and also grab some cocoa, kick it on the couch, and then grab your phone and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at 2819 Show.
Definitely post some pictures of your Christmas sweaters and garb and all that fun stuff.
Wait, doesn't this? It does.
I think, like, literally my coworkers are tired of seeing this and hearing this one, but I'm going to wear it at least 5 more times before Christmas. Anyway, if you want the podcast version of this, you can get us on most major podcast services. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
Meowie Christmas.